I'm Rosemary Martirana, Director of Intelligence here at the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, NJOHSP, and you're listening to Intelligence Unclassified. This podcast is exactly what the title states, unclassified information about current trends in homeland security for the state of New Jersey, as well as educational information and resources for your awareness. Although it is produced every month, we aim to stay on top of current events and will often offer additional content. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow NJOHSP on Twitter at NJOHSP and Facebook. All links can be found in the show note and on our website, www.njohsp.gov. Hi, this is Rosemary Martirana, Director of Intelligence here at the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. On March 18th, our office hosted its 10th anniversary conference, where over 600 of our public and private sector partners joined us to engage in valuable dialogue surrounding counterterrorism, resiliency, and cybersecurity issues. The day's events included insightful presentations from a wide array of experts who then graciously sat down with our podcast to delve deeper into some of their topics. Over the next several weeks, we will be hearing from the likes of Clint Watts, a Robert A. Fox Fellow for the Program on the Middle East and Senior Fellow for the Program on National Security at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, Lauren Steinberg, a Terrorism Analyst for the Anti-Defamation League's Center on Extremism, Hassan Safar, a Senior Civil Rights and Civil Liberties Official at the United States Department of Homeland Security, Deb Delvecchio Scully, a Counselor and Trauma Specialist serving the Sandy Hook Newtown community, and Police Chief Jared Bergwan of San Bernardino.
Good morning. My name is Kim Brown. I'm the Deputy Bureau Chief of the Analysis Bureau for the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. And today we'll be talking to Lauren Steinberg. Lauren Steinberg is a terrorism analyst for the Anti-Defamation League's Center on Extremism, responsible for monitoring the threat and activities of Islamic extremist organizations and their adherents at home and abroad. Prior to her current position, Ms. Steinberg worked as an assistant director in the ADL's New York office and as a research assistant for the Terrorism Research Initiative in an international research consortium dedicated to collaborative research on terrorism studies that publishes the journal Perspectives on Terrorism. Ms. Steinberg has a master's degree from Columbia University in political science with a focus on international security and undergraduate degrees in political science and religion. She will be discussing today social media recruitment by international and domestic terrorist groups. So I just want to say thank you, Lauren, for coming and speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So today, one of the questions that we'll be discussing is, again, the differences of IT and DT recruitment. Would you be able to describe the difference and similarities in how DT and IT groups recruit using social media?
For sure. So both DT and IT groups were very early adapters of social media. From the time when most social engagement on the internet was restricted to forums and perhaps MySpace, they were encouraging their followers to get online, connect with each other, and be a part of a social online movement. And there are very strong reasons for that, because if you can be part of this extremist organization online, you have the capacity to isolate the types of information that you're getting and the types of friends that you're having to all people who agree with you and can reinforce your extremist message. A lot of the differences actually come into play when we look at the social networks that people are building on the ground here in the United States outside of social media. Domestic extremist individuals are much more likely to have a peer network here in America of people who are also engaged with extremism. Perhaps their family members are involved, perhaps their friends are involved, and these people and the social networks that they build through, you know, social activities like barbecues or rallies and other such events are very fundamental elements of keeping them in the group that is then reinforced on the internet. For international terrorist organizations, it's much more difficult to find those peers, and I wouldn't want to say that they don't find them, because the strongest means of recruiting is a combination of in-person and online recruitment and radicalization. But the international folks either are finding their in-person peers through the internet to begin with, or if they do find them at home, friends, family members, or the like, and we do see a lot of family members radicalizing together also, if they do find them at home, they're strongly reinforced and getting their primary reinforcement from the internet, which I think would be the primary difference.
And is the reinforcement from the internet through those interactions, or is it more so the radicalization that we're seeing with the videos?
It's very much a combination. I think the interactions are the strongest proponent of constant reinforcement of the message, but those interactions include videos. So someone might send a video that they've been watching, a propaganda video that they've been watching, to another person via a mobile app or via a social media platform. Similarly, when you're, let's say, on Twitter, your whole social network is consistently sharing these official propaganda videos and messages. So it's a combination that happens very much at the same time.
You mentioned encrypted apps. So with the advancements in technology, is that making it easier or harder for these groups? And what does that mean for law enforcement?
I don't know that it makes it easier or harder, because it's happening at the same time as they're having a much harder time on traditional social media. Twitter, Facebook, and the like are rapidly very active in deleting extremist accounts from their platforms. And while extremist accounts do still exist, they're at a much slower rate and a much lower level than they were even 6 or 7 months ago. So the move to apps has been motivated in part by attempts for encryption and in privacy, but also because they're losing their other online spaces. Now, of course, the encryption does make it much harder for law enforcement to find the information after the fact. At the same time, undercover law enforcement investigations can have encrypted conversations with extremists on mobile apps, where the extremist might feel that much more comfortable sharing what their plot is. So it goes both ways.
When we look at groups like white supremacists, they create categories within their forums that cater to different preferences, such as dating, self-defense, how to respond to family and friends. Are international terrorist groups doing the same thing?
Very much so. And I don't know, I wouldn't say that they're necessarily doing it in structured categories, but they have all those same themes. They have propaganda that's directed at women. They have propaganda that's directed at people who are feeling disenfranchised from their families and from their communities, directed at people who have converted, and they really try to seek out people with these aspirations and give them messages that they feel will appeal to them to start out with.
And when we look at international and domestic terrorist groups, what type of people are they recruiting? Are they looking for youth, military experience, or are they not selective?
They're certainly not selective. The types of people that are recruited, however, have certain common features. And the most common of those is a person who perceives, true or false, that he or she doesn't belong, that he or she is alienated, perhaps bullied, perhaps doesn't have a place, doesn't have a next goal, doesn't feel like they can be a contributing member of society and a full-fledged member of society. And so that's why these extremist groups appeal to them. So the extremists will try to seek out people in different categories. ISIS, for example, has been trying to appeal to former military personnel, saying, your country is not supporting you. You have PTSD. You're having trouble finding a job. We support our people. Your country isn't. They're trying to appeal to minority groups in America, saying, look at the Black Lives Matter movement. America's a racist country. We're not a racist movement. We're going to support you, and the like. So they try to seek out these disenfranchised groups. Youth, of course, because they're perhaps more susceptible and less discerning of propaganda, and also because younger people have grown up with social media and are so fully immersed in it, seeking answers to their questions, seeking ideas about how they're going to live their lives online, are that much more likely to encounter it. And of course, younger people are also that much more likely to join extremist movements to begin with.
With the presidential campaign and the different candidates' views that we're seeing, is that something that IT groups such as ISIS would hone in on and try to capitalize on?
Absolutely. Again, these groups are looking for sources of disenfranchisement, and their strongest message has long been, Muslims do not fit in Western countries. You're not wanted. You don't have a place. You cannot be a full member of that country. And the only way you can be a full-fledged member of society is by joining a group where you can live out your religious identity to the fullest in the way that ISIS believes it should be lived out. Of course, that's not the way most Muslim Americans believe in it, but ISIS would argue it's the only real way to do so. And so building on campaign rhetoric that Muslims don't belong, that Muslims can't be part of society, is exactly the kind of split, the kind of black and white split that Islamic extremist groups attempt to appeal to.
If we look specifically at IT groups, how have they been most successful in their online recruitment? And can you describe why they've been successful as compared to other groups?
Sure. IT groups have done two things, I think, that most seriously impacted their success. Number one was creating an interactive platform. So beginning as early as Inspire magazine, published by Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, they were actively encouraging readers to contribute, to send in whatever skills they have, whether they're graphic design skills, whether they're IT skills, whether they're fighting skills. Send us your skills, send us your submissions, be a part of this. Once someone feels like he's an important contributing member, now he feels like he really has a space within that group or she and can be a greater part of it and might want to seek more involvement. And the second thing, which I think is less known, is that groups, especially ISIS, this is really what they have pioneered, have had a really broad spectrum of messaging. So all the messaging in the end comes down to be a part of something bigger, be a part of something greater, make a difference, and this is the only way you can do it. But you get at that in different ways. You know, when we think of ISIS propaganda, we think of beheadings, we think of brutality. And that's actually a very small fraction of what it is. The vast majority are these utopian scenes. You know, look at all the flavors and colors of ice cream we have in ISIS-controlled territory. Look at these really happy little kids. Look at these soldiers and their camaraderie that they have, that they share despite, by the way, their different ethnicities and backgrounds and the like. And by appealing to this sense of utopianism and this sense of perfectionism and religious ideals, they're saying, we really are creating a perfect and just society. And people who, again, don't feel like they have a space in our society, in our Western society or America, might feel that this is a place for them.
Well, are other groups learning from what ISIS is doing? And if so, can you explain or provide an example?
Sure, absolutely. So Al-Shabaab is actually a really good example, Al-Qaeda in Somalia. They have an English and Swahili language magazine, Gaidi Matani, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And it has recently, more than it used to, been very active at looking at sources of social disenfranchisement in the U.S. and trying to promote a utopian alternative. They've been doing this for some time, and Al-Shabaab video as early as around 2010 compared Al-Shabaab in Somalia to Disneyland. But it's on a much greater scale now. So there was an article recently that focused on problems with gangs in the Somali-American community. And it listed all these really bad things that happen when you live in the West. It said, you know, there's violence and there's drugs and there's poverty and there's premarital sexual relations was one of the things they mentioned. And they said, we're not doing that. We're building God's society. We're building a utopian society. And you can be a part of that as well. So we see that message trickling through a lot of groups.
The next question is, you touched on this in one of the previous questions, but are there any links between mainstream political debates or controversies and extremist activities?
100%. And again, as noted, one of the main ways this comes through is in propaganda, trying to get at issues that are polarizing in society, cracks in society, places where people might feel disenfranchised, and trying to say, you have a space here. At the time of another example, at the time of the Ferguson riots, ISIS had a whole series of propaganda with the hashtag Ferguson saying, there is no racism in Islam. You can join us. We're not racist like America is, and you can be a part of our much better movement. The other flip side of that is that as mainstream political debates have the propensity to isolate and marginalize individuals here in the U.S. and throughout the West, that leaves them potentially, I certainly wouldn't say there's a direct causal link, but potentially more susceptible to extremist propaganda and ideologies.
What do you think is the most difficult part for law enforcement in combating online recruitment by domestic and international terrorist groups?
Law enforcement's in a really tough space in combating recruitment specifically because they're seen as the establishment, right? Law enforcement is the man. And if you're looking, you're saying, I don't belong here and I don't have authority figures here that I can trust and I don't have a space here where I can be, you're looking for something countercultural. You know, the same people joining these groups, I like to say, would have joined a motorcycle gang 20 years ago. So law enforcement isn't the immediate person you'd think of as reassuring and helpful. And I think in recruitment and radicalization, law enforcement is often on the defensive side, right? After it's happened, law enforcement can come in and arrest a radical individual. It's, of course, by building strong ties with communities and making themselves people that individuals can trust and can feel are positive sources of authority and leadership that law enforcement can start to work with communities to counter negative messaging, and has been.
So if we're looking at other countries, are other countries attempting different ways to stop online recruitment and radicalization? And is there one thing that we can learn from them?
There are a host of efforts in other countries to combat this. One place that's really active right now, of course, is Western Europe, where there's been a tremendous amount of recruitment of communities of local populations to join ISIS and to join other extremist groups. And I'm actually really interested in why that's been so prevalent in Western Europe. Part of it, of course, is geography. They're closer to Syria. It's more accessible. But part of it is also a lack of integration of immigrant groups. So if you're a second-generation Turkish person living in Germany, for example, you can't feel fully German, because to be fully German, traditionally, is to look German, to have a faith in common with other Germans, and you're not that. And you're also not fully Turkish, because you've grown up in Germany. And so you're stuck, so you're looking for an alternative. So the number one problem there is the need to better integrate people. And that's what I think the U.S. has a very excellent and helpful edge on, because we do that. You can be Turkish American and be fully American. You can be Somali American and be fully American. And one thing that a lot of European countries have been working on extensively is to develop more policies for critical consumption of internet use, to develop a lot more civil rights-oriented programs against bias. And that's something that we're absolutely working on here too, I think with a lot of success.
And if we were to look ahead to late 2016, early 2017, how do you see recruitment changing?
Right now, I think terrorist organizations have a bit of a message problem, actually. You know, we talk, and this is really good, we talk a lot about how, oh, ISIS recruitment is so strong, it's so powerful, and so many people joined. And yeah, there was a major spike. There were about 80 U.S. residents linked to terrorism motivated by foreign terrorist organizations in 2015, compared to just short of 30 in 2014. Again, a drop in the bucket of the U.S. population, but still a very significant change. But ISIS doesn't have all that much going for them now, nor does Al-Qaeda, right? Al-Qaeda is embattled in a variety of different places. In Yemen, AQAP is in the midst of a civil war. In Africa, Boko Haram is struggling to maintain its integrity. Al-Shabaab's doing quite well, but they're very locally focused, and other groups as well. And ISIS in Syria and Iraq is rapidly losing territory, A. B, social media groups and online groups more broadly are working in a much more concerted effort, and I'm happy to say the ADL has been a big part of this, a much more concerted effort to ensure that they have terms of service that limit extremist exploitation of their sites. So, number one, there's a lot less opportunity for terrorist groups to be using those sites. It's absolutely still prevalent, but a fraction of what it was even 6 or 7 months ago. And at the same time, they don't have new messages. It's all the same things being repeated that they were saying a year ago over and over and over again. There's a dangerous element here, because that means they'll want to stage an attack so they can have something new to say. Mm-hmm. But it also means that they don't have new means of getting at people that might be interested. And I think it gives us a really strong opportunity to invest much more strongly in counter-narrative and in counter-messaging to say, we know what the message is. We get it. Do you see how it hasn't changed, how it's lying, and how you can actually be much more an integral part and an important part of society here by investing in yourself here rather than believing in these people who are effectively sending you to die?
So if the message is not changing, do you think then that the focus or the recruitment of groups such as ISIS, they'll start to be more specific and say, okay, we'll recruit the youth? They seem to be more impressionable as opposed to someone who might be a little older and might be viewing our sites and seeing that the information is not changing?
Sort of. I don't know that it's an age-differentiated situation, in that mostly the youth are the people who are going to join this to begin with, but we do see age ranges. In recent years, since 2009, the youngest person linked to terrorism motivated by foreign organizations in the U.S. was 15. The oldest person was 76. So the majority are very much in their 20s, but there is a gap here. There is a range. What I do think we'll see in terms of change in messaging is groups more actively saying, go out yourself and commit a domestic attack, commit a small-scale lone wolf attack, because they don't have strength in their countries, because they need violence to say, we're still active, we're still fighting. And so the message is going to change from come join us, come travel, to try to commit an attack. And that's certainly something, as these groups lose strength, that we have to be on the alert for.
Well, Lauren, I'd like to thank you for coming out and speaking with NJOHSP and answering some of our questions. It was great speaking with you.
Thank you so much. Great speaking with you.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.